Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 1st of October 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and we are streaming live tonight for the first time in quite a while, and we haven't had a live show for the last 2 weeks, I think. So I'm looking forward to this, and I'm also looking forward to greeting my co-host once again, who is back in the country, I believe. Patriot, how are you doing and did you have a safe journey back?
Hey, good to be back. Yeah, I'm very well, thanks. Safe journey, quite smooth, although obviously greeted with the cold English weather. Bit of a difference. It was quite funny actually. On the plane ride, obviously we was getting close to the UK. In the land, kind of getting ready to land, descend into the UK, England. And it was really, really sunny. And obviously we sent through the clouds and it's like, oh yeah, here's England. And it was just full on grey. It's just typical.
Back to the rain again. Well, it must have been nice to get away and enjoy the summer over the other side of Europe and then come back, and hasn't been too bad here today. We're talking about sunny climate once again in the show. We're going to be talking about Egypt. Of course, the climate was different back then. It was quite fertile in Egypt. It wasn't so desert-like as it is today. And today is episode 14, and we're going to be talking about multicultural Egypt, the first time that it actually became multicultural. And in the last episode, we were talking about the Great Pyramid, and we talked about how there's a lot of evidence to show that it was a descendant of Shem that actually built that pyramid. And that's going to tie into some of the stuff that we're going to be talking about either in this episode or in the next episode. So there's going to be a continuing thread through the story, really, from the building of that pyramid. But getting back to the civilization itself, or before we get into that, actually, there was something else that I brought up in the episode last time, and that was about this oil that came from the crocodile. And some scholars tell us that the Israelites took the idea of a messiah from Egypt, as the word was originally an Egyptian term for someone who had been anointed with an oil called Missa, which was derived from the Nile crocodile. But the tradition of anointing kings is common to all Aryan religions. This is how the prophets or priests would signify God's approval of a contender for kingship. Samuel anointed Saul, the first king of Israel, with oil, the same as the Brahmins of India did, the Egyptians, and the Druids. The word Messiah means anointed one, and it means someone anointed with oil to set them apart as holy to God. It actually means the same as the word Christ, and it can be plural, as in the word Christians, which means the anointed ones. The use of this custom and the word for it shows a common heritage. It does not show that the Israelites stole the custom. It was a common tradition among the white nations of the world, just as much as the symbol of spearing the dragon is, which originated in the spearing of the crocodile on the Nile. And we talked about that before as well. And this anointing that was done with the oil, this was also done for our kings. And it was a very important part of the coronation ceremony that the king would be anointed with oil. And this goes all the way back to this oil that they used to get from the crocodile back there in Egypt. And that's actually where this word Messiah comes from, this original word Mesa for the crocodile, apparently. Were you aware of that?
I wonder, why do you think oil is chosen as a liquid, or form to represent purity? Was it significant about oil, do you think?
I don't know. I mean, obviously it's different to water. Your body itself produces lots of different oils, doesn't it? And they're actually using an oil from the crocodile. I must admit, I don't know. Hormones, are oils that the body produces. The endorphin glands or the endocrine glands produce all different oils that can affect mood and all sorts of things, really. So I must admit, I don't know why it was oil and not water. I guess baptism is using water, isn't it? So, and this oil is used for something different.
I think I'm pretty sure that the oils are quite synonymous with spirituality and and things like that, absorbing spirits, and I don't know, some it has a quality about it, but that's just kind of off the top of my head, I remember reading a while back. But also I wonder, before the Israelites and whatnot, are there any cases where oil was used in the Bible, for example, going as far back as Noah? Do we know?
Not that I'm aware of. And I was just thinking then as well, perhaps fragrance and, you know, oils that would have a fragrance. Frankincense. I had frankincense a while back, and that was almost like an oil. It was like a sort of crystalline sort of thing, and when you burned it, it was like an oil. So maybe it was a fragrance thing to it as well. In fact, I think I remember when I was reading about the coronation of the king, there was a beautiful fragrance came from the oil, and he would smell of this beautiful fragrance for a week after, and not wash this off. This especially fragrant oil. So it must have had a fragrance to it as well, a very important fragrance.
Yeah.
But I can't think of... maybe that was it, that it had this fragrance and that was what was so important about it, rather than the fact it was oil. I have to look into it some more.
It's something to consider. I mean, since it's so commonly associated with blessing and pouring oils and Jesus, there was oil, wasn't it, or perfume? Was that perfume where he's washed with oils?
Yeah, washed with oils. So it would be a certain fragrance with them. And I think there was, I think there's part of the Orthodox Church, they have something called a chrism, which is also to do with oil, which they do after people have been baptized. It all goes back to this crocodile, apparently. And then again, we've also got this image of Michael spearing the dragon, and you've got this original image of the pharaoh spearing a crocodile, or one of the original Egyptian deities spearing a crocodile. Moving away from the esoteric ideas here, aside from the stupendous achievement of building the pyramids, the white civilization of Egypt is credited with many achievements, some of which benefit us to this day. The Egyptians were the first to divide the solar year into 365 and one quarter days based on a 12-month cycle. And we showed that the measurements of the pyramid show this 365-day year is actually encoded into the pyramid. Also, they knew about this 12-month cycle. The Egyptians also became famous for their medical skills, although the difference between magic and science does not appear to have been fully made. Evidence exists of advanced surgery having been carried out as far back as the First Kingdom, and many techniques and herbal remedies were taken over by the classical Greeks and survived right into medieval European times. And there are some fantastic pictures of the dental work that they used to do. They used to actually make bridges up. They would get a tooth that had fallen out, and they would drill a hole through it, and then they would get golden thread and tie that around the hole, and then they would get gold wire and they would put that around the remaining teeth that were actually in the jaw, and they would have this like a make a bridge up, basically. It was the first dental bridges that they used to do. They used to know how to remove organs. I'm not sure that they knew how to do organ transplants, probably not, but they certainly knew how to remove the organs, and it is quite a skilled job to do that with the mummification. So they were probably the most advanced at surgery at that time, were the Egyptians. As we saw, the Indus Valley civilization, they were the most advanced with waterworks and sanitation and wells. I mean, each of these civilizations, they were far in advance of everything else in the world at that time. But they also had things that they specialized in, and the Egyptians later on, they specialized in these great monuments that are still standing there today. And in contrast to Mesopotamian writing, Egyptian writing, the hieroglyphics, which means sacred signs, remained pictorial in content throughout the span of the civilization. The entire span of the civilization, they had those pictorial signs. And Egyptian writing was only deciphered in 1822 after the discovery of the Rosetta Stone. The Rosetta Stone had the same piece of text in three languages: Demotic Egyptian, Hieroglyphic Egyptian, and Ancient Greek. And because we were able to understand Ancient Greek, we were then able to understand Egyptian. It was the French philologist Jean-François Champollion who was the first to translate it, and he enabled us to read what the Egyptians were saying on their monuments, and that's when we would have learned more about their knowledge of medicine and surgery and all that sort of thing. Do you want to comment on any of that?
Yeah, I'm just looking at the some of the images now of the dental work. I mean, that's quite fascinating, really, to think that they will be able to do that so far back. I mean, the equipment to achieve that level of dental work would have been quite high tech as well, the drills and stuff, you know, all the little mechanisms that would have been required. It's quite interesting. But also on the topic of their pictorial, you know, communication, written language, I wonder why they chose that form of communication. If you compare it to some civilization like the Sumerians, where it's kind of stark contrast, it almost looks like a written or a, you know, visual math form of writing. And then you've got the Egyptians who are kind of got all these elaborate pictures, pictograms. I just wonder if that plays into a particular reason. Maybe it's something to do with them being, you know, sort of, I'll say, quite egotistical in how they wanted to portray themselves. Maybe they wanted something that was a bit more personified and visual, so it could communicate on a mass level. Because I mean, obviously there's some things that needed to be deciphered, but you can also look at it and kind of still get an inkling for what's going off in the picture.
I think it may have been to do with papyrus and the fact that they were using papyrus as the medium. If you're using clay, then they were like cutting in marks to it. If you're using wood, then you're going to be cutting things into it again, which is why we get runes. Whereas if you're using papyrus and maybe you're painting on there, then it's not going to be such a sharp mark that you're putting on there. That may have had something to do with it. And it may have been that in the other civilizations, it started out with pictorial language, and then they moved on from that to using something similar to the alphabet. I mean, it may have been something to do with that. I guess they don't really know. We do know that there's two different types of hieroglyphs. You've got the demotic, and you've also got the hieroglyphic. So the hieroglyphic was the pictures, and then that evolved into what's called demotic Egyptian. And I think the priests would use the hieroglyphic Egyptian, and the normal people would use the demotic Egyptian. So the priests kept one particular language for themselves. But it may have been something to do with the medium that they were using, like papyrus instead of clay or wood.
But you get sometimes when you see like a panel of a wall, you almost get a mixture, don't you? You have almost like an illustration, and then you have the hieroglyphics. Is that literally just what it is, an illustration, and I'm mistaking the, you know, kind of the elaborate pictures of almost the godlike men?
No, the pictures are the hieroglyphics, where you've got things like a feather, or you've got an image of a flag, and if you look at the cartouches that they had, these little oval shaped bits of wood or what have you, and on that it would have somebody's name, and somebody's name would be made up of two different pictorial images, like the name of the pharaoh. So you are thinking of the writing. That is writing. But I guess when they were putting it on walls and what have you, it was painted on there rather than it being cut in there with a knife, as it would have been if they were doing it on a clay tablet, or if they were doing it on wood. They would need to be carving it in with a chisel. Whereas if you're painting on a wall, you can use a brush and you can paint these things and make round curves instead of sharp lines and angles, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, no, yeah, I see what you're saying. I guess it's just, when I look at the, let's say, a wall panel, they always tend to have, an obvious picture of someone, and then they've got the hieroglyphics around it. Is the picture just like a supporting illustration?
Well, yeah, and in a lot of cases, I mean, you might have a picture of the pharaoh doing something, and then the writing that would be around it would be saying who the pharaoh is and what he had achieved. And a lot of the times they had really long titles as well. Ruler of the two lands, vanquisher of the foes, beloved of the gods, the pharaoh, whatever his name is. So they'd give them a really long title. And that's where they come from, is all the hieroglyphics that would surround them. And they'd also have a fairly short title with these cartouches that almost like dog tags. You know, like we have dog tags today, and that gives the information about the person. It was similar to that, but they were for the pharaohs. They actually had these cartouches, and they found these things in the tombs, just with their name on them, basically. Like I said, it's similar to the dog tags today. But yeah, I think it's probably because of the medium that they were actually writing on. Because it's easier to do curves on papyrus or on a wall than, you know, if you're using a sharp stick and trying to do that in clay, basically. That's why the Sumerian stuff is so angular. It's all straight lines and angles, because they were using a stylus on wet clay, basically. So that, I think, is the reason for that.
So the limitations defined their level of communication.
Yeah.
Effectively.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we have paper today, and we use fountain pens and ballpoint pens. And that's where the cursive style came from, and the joined up writing as well is from writing on paper. But of course, the problem with that is that paper falls apart. And what's the other one? Vellum, I think it is, which was or parchment, and you also get animal skins that they used to use. Animal skins would last a lot longer, but the ones that would last the longest are, of course, those clay tablets that the Sumerians used. And they've lasted all the way to today, thousands of years old.
The Egyptians used papyrus for a lot, didn't they?
Yeah,
recording a lot, and I mean that's one of the only thing things I remember coming away from learning about Egypt in school was that there was a significant event, I think, that took place whereby so much of their papyrus and writings and knowledge was burned. Are you aware of that? Is that it was burned and lost to history?
Maybe you're thinking of the Library at Alexandria. Yeah, the Library at Alexandria, that was in Egypt. I mean, that was much later on, and all the information that was there was burned up. And that was named after Alexander the Great, which is 1,000 years after when we're talking about now. So 1,000 years later. We'll get to Alexander the Great later on. And I mean, it was named after him, but the actual burning down of the library, that didn't happen until after Christ. I'm not sure exactly what date. 100 AD, 200 AD, something like that. But it was in Egypt. But yeah, that was the risk that you have with writing on paper, is that it can very easily be burnt.
And here we are today, storing data on the blockchain.
Yeah. Yeah, how secure is that, I wonder? Well, around 1800 BC, the last great ruler of the Middle Kingdom, Amenemhat III, allowed Semitic-speaking Canaanite settlers from the Near East into the Delta region to provide a sufficient labor force for his especially active mining and building campaigns. These ambitious building and mining activities, however, combined with several Nile floods later in his reign, and strained the economy and precipitated the slow decline into the second intermediate period during the later 13th and 14th dynasties. During this decline, the Canaanite settlers began to assume greater control of the Delta region, eventually coming to power in Egypt and being known as the Hyksos occupation. It was actually the second Hyksos occupation. And remember, we talked about how the builders of the pyramid, they were known as the Hyksos, which just meant foreigners, basically. And this second group of foreigners, this second group of Hyksos, they were a completely different ethnicity. These were Canaanite settlers. And we can see that what's happened here is the Egyptians have allowed this other ethnicity to come in and live among them. And within 100 years or so, they've ended up taking over the whole place. So they've assumed control in the Delta region. And eventually they assumed control right at the top of Egypt by the Mediterranean. And the actual original people of Egypt, they ended up lower down, and they ended up sandwiched between these Canaanite Hyksos at the top and the Nubians at the bottom. And they got into quite a state, as we'll see. We'll go into a lot of detail in this. And these Canaanite settlers, this Hyksos group, they're most well known for actually having horse and chariot. And I was looking on Wikipedia today, and it was saying, but this is what they're most well known for, yet we don't actually find any archaeological evidence to show that they had horses and chariots. We base this on the fact that they buried their horses. And that's the only thing that's actually built upon. And this group, this Hyksos group, they didn't actually bring any new technology with them either. And yet they were able to take over somehow.
Yeah, I mean, I read an article which suggests that the Hyksos, I think I might have spoke with you on this before, but that they suggest that the Hyksos came in as migrants and sojourners, and were kind of homegrown, and basically an uprising fermented, and that's when they eventually took over. But it wasn't necessarily a marching in and conquering type scenario, but rather one that just happened gradually over time. What do you think about that?
Well, it says here that they came in originally, there weren't that many of them, and then later on there were great battles. Manetho talks about there being battles with them, but he may be getting that quote from Manetho may be getting mixed up with the first group that came in and actually built the pyramid. But we do know that they were a league between the Levantine people and the Syria and the people that were living in Syria. So the people that were living in Phoenicia before the Phoenician Empire, which was the Hittites and other Canaanites, and the people that were living in the Levant before the Israelites, which were Canaanites. So it was basically a league of Canaanite people. And if you look at the images of them, you can see very clearly that they are Canaanites. You can see very clearly that they're very similar to today's modern Jews as well. And when Josephus was writing about this, which was 2,000 years later, or just under 2,000 years later, he was suggesting that this Hyksos group were the Israelites. So you can see that this confusion had occurred by the time of Joseph's time, and he was thinking that this Hyksos group were actually the Israelites, and they weren't. They were the Canaanites. And we'll see more evidence for that later on. But the mainstream narrative today is that this was around the time of Moses, or when Joseph came in, he found friends among the Hyksos, and the truth is the complete opposite of that. Does that help?
Yeah, I think so.
Right, around 1785 BC, as the power of the Middle Kingdom kings weakened, the Western Asian people the Egyptians called the Hyksos, who had already settled in the Delta, seized control of Egypt and established their capital at Avaris, forcing the former central government to retreat to Thebes. And that's right down the bottom there. That's down near Nubia. So basically the Hyksos took over the area by the Mediterranean, the best bit where all the fertile ground was. And the king, the Egyptian king, was treated as a vassal, and he was expected to pay tribute. So he was paying taxes to this Hyksos group. The Hyksos, which means foreign rulers, retained Egyptian models of government and identified as kings, thereby integrating Egyptian elements into their culture. They and other invaders introduced new tools of warfare into Egypt, most notably the composite bow and the horse-drawn chariot. And as I pointed out, there's no actual archaeological evidence for them having horse-drawn chariots. There is references to the Egyptians being in horse-drawn chariots. They also brought the sickle-shaped sword with them, and apparently the composite bow, but that was it. And they didn't introduce their own system of ruling or anything like that. They just copied the Egyptian one, basically. They didn't have a civilization of their own, but they were able to take over this Egyptian one somehow. That's how it looks anyway, because they didn't bring any other technology. just the sword and this bow, which is nothing really. And we've got a quote here from The Bible as History by Werner Keller, pages 86 to 88. And just before I get into that, I'll just say some of this information I got from Clifton Emmerheiser's Watchman Teaching Letters, which I really do recommend. And this quote comes from one of those. And we'll talk a bit more about Clifton Emmerheiser in a bit and his work. This is from The Bible as History by Werner Keller. Something incredible and frightful befell the Nile country about 1730 BC. Suddenly, as a bolt from the blue, warriors in chariots drove into the country like arrows shot from a bow. Endless columns of them in clouds of dust. Day and night, horses' hooves thundered past the frontier posts, rang through city streets, temple squares, and the majestic courts of Pharaoh's palaces. Even before the Egyptians had realized it, it had happened. Their country was taken by surprise, overrun, and vanquished. The giant of the Nile, who never before in his history had seen foreign conquerors, lay bound and prostrate. The rule of the victors began with a bloodbath. The Hyksos, Semitic tribes from Canaan and Syria, knew no pity. With the fateful year 1730 BC, the 1300-year rule of the dynasties came to an abrupt end. The Middle Kingdom of the Pharaohs was shattered under the onslaught of these Asian peoples, the rulers of foreign lands. That is the meaning of the name Hyksos. The memory of their political disaster remained alive among the Nile people as a striking description by the Egyptian historian Manetho, who testified, "We had a king called Tutimaeus. In his reign it happened. I do not know why God was displeased with us. Unexpectedly, from the regions of the east came men of an unknown race. Confident of victory, they marched against our land. By force they took it, easily, without a single battle. Having overpowered our rulers, they burned our cities without compassion and destroyed the temples of the gods. All the natives were treated with great cruelty, for they slew some and carried off the wives and children of others into slavery. Finally, they appointed one of themselves as king. His name was Seletus, and he lived in Memphis, and he made Upper and Lower Egypt pay tribute to him and set up garrisons in places which would be most useful to him. And when he found a city in the province of Sais, which suited his purpose, it lay east of the Bubastite branch of the Nile and was called Avaris, he rebuilt it and made it very strong by erecting walls and installing a force of 240,000 men to hold it. Solitis went there every summer, partly to collect his corn and to pay his men their wages, and partly to train his armed troops and to terrify foreigners." So that's a description of what happened. So it was a violent takeover, basically. So it sounds like there were a small number of them there at first, and then suddenly a large number of them came in. So maybe the Egyptians welcomed them in and treated them as friends, and maybe they got word back to the rest of them that were in Syria and the Levant, and then they suddenly came steaming in on horseback and took the place.
Like a Trojan, they kind of sussed the place out.
It sounds like it.
And then attacked when it's at its weakest point, maybe.
It sounds like it. As I say, I got that quote from Clifton Emmerheiser, because I was looking into this a couple of years back for a series I did called Aryan Esoterica, and I'm going to use quotes from that. But after I finished that series, I read Clifton Emmerheiser's work, and he came across exactly the same theory as me, basically, but he ended up with different evidence to show that this theory was truthful. So I'm going to add some of his work to my work, and also the quotes from other books which Clifton Emmerheiser found that bear out this theory. And this is what Clifton has to say about it. He says, "At their height, the Hyksos occupied the land of the Hurrians, Carchemish, Syria, Palestine, and much of the northern part of Egypt. By inhabiting the delta area of Egypt, they were in control of all the commerce on the Nile. This cut Egypt off almost entirely from commercial trade and the rest of the then known world. The Hyksos could sit in their fortress at Avaris and call all the shots up and down the Nile. These Hyksos were a very strange people, desiring to set up a government like that of the Egyptians. It makes one wonder why they did not set up a government like the one they had wherever they came from, wherever that was. They seemed to be a kind of chameleon type of people, adapting themselves to their surroundings. Some students believe the Hyksos came from the Caucasus or even Central Asia, but at least as far as the Egyptians were concerned, the Hyksos were an Asiatic people. The Hyksos seem to have been active merchants. They introduced into Egypt a new system of weights and balances. Does this seem to ring a bell of any kind? It kind of makes me wonder who the Hyksos people were. We can be sure that they were not Egyptian or Israelite, though. And that's what Clifton has to say about this. And I think he's pointing out the fact that because they introduced a new system of weights and measures, weights and balances, they were merchants, basically, a merchant type. And they didn't bring anything new of their own, basically. But they were able to take over.
And when they say Asiatic, I mean, by today's standards, people would think Asian as in, you know, an Arab-like, or Asian as in, you know, what would you call it, Oriental type. But back then, Asiatic would have referred to a different type of race, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it's referring to the Canaanite Arab type. When you look at the Egyptians themselves, they classified people by their race, and they had an Asiatic type and an Egyptian type and a Nubian type. What else did they have? I think they had I think it was a Libyan type, which was called Cyrenia, I think, at the time. But there's a famous picture which shows four different types of men that the Egyptians produced. So they would refer to this type as an Asiatic type. It wasn't a white man, basically. Okay. It wasn't a white man, and it wasn't a Nubian. It was a different type of man, what they're saying, it was a Canaanite type. You know, that says to me it was one of these types that were originally there in Sumeria, that moved out from Sumeria to the land of Canaan, basically, because we talked about Canaan and how he would have had to have married the women that were already there instead of marrying marrying into the tribes that his brothers were the patriarchs of, because he had that curse put on him. So it was probably descendants of Canaan who would have looked slightly different, obviously, to the white men, the people of Egypt and the people of Cush, and from the land of Cush.
Yeah, just I get confused sometimes placing the geographical locations and labels. Like in the New Testament, Paul refers to some locations such as Asia Minor, doesn't he? And I thought they were mostly synonymous with whites.
Asia Minor was at that time. Asia Minor at this time had the Hittites in it.
Right.
Asia Minor had Phoenicia, and it had the area that became known as Phoenicia that the Israelites moved into, and they moved the Canaanites out from that area. So at this time that we're talking about now, Asia Minor, the area that we now know as Syria, that had Canaanites in it. And also the Levant, the area that we know now as Palestine and Israel, that also had Canaanites in it. And it was a league of these two groups that came in. And I guess that's why he's calling it Asiatic, because it's Asia Minor.
Okay. But then there were periods where it became synonymous with whites and Israelites and whatnot. So that was after they went in and conquered. But they were still living amongst them, right, as well?
In some parts. I mean, what they did, they got rid of most of them. And in some parts, they got rid of them entirely. And then one tribe conned them, didn't they? And they said, we'll make a league with you against the Canaanites. And they made a league with them to fetch their water and cut their wood. And then they discovered that they were actually Canaanites, but they'd made a treaty with them. They'd made a promise with them. So they couldn't exterminate them or kick them out.
Wasn't that the Hittites or Amorites or something?
One of the Canaanite tribes. And in the land of Moab, they removed all the Moabites from the land of Moab. We're told that the ones that went into what is now Syria, that became known as Phoenicia, they removed them all entirely. They were all removed entirely from that area. They had to move out from that area. So that area was taken over and it was white. And then you get David and Solomon, and Solomon's empire stretched to Palmyra, which is in North Syria. So that would have been all white. But then after that, centuries after that, the Canaanites came in again. And at the time when the Babylonians and the Assyrians came in and they sacked Israel and they sacked Judah, by that time, there was all different peoples there, because Jeremiah castigates them for it, doesn't he? And he says, you've got mixed race people living among you. And then once they'd actually been removed from those areas, then Canaanites moved in again. The Edomites moved in and they took over the land of Judah, while the tribe of Judah had been removed. And then when the tribe of Judah came back, they removed them again for a bit, but then they interbred with them and shared their religion with them and said, we'll all call ourselves Jews together, in about the second century BC. So there was times when the area was white and it was an ethno-state, and there are other times when it became multicultural, and after it became multicultural, they lost the country. And that happens every time with every civilization. Once it becomes multicultural, it's on limited time until it's the end of the civilization. That's really the lesson from this.
Yeah, I guess so. And then there's migrations elsewhere.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, just one other point to add to that. I mean, we've all been concerned what's going to happen when civilization falls this time. But we do still have the East. And when a lot of people were really concerned about what's going to happen this time, we had the Iron Curtain was still up and the Soviet Union was still there. That's not there anymore. And Russia and the Russian Federation is still 99% white. You've got some countries that are non-white that are part of that federation. But maybe they're in Moscow, maybe they're in the main cities, but they're not everywhere else. And Russia certainly wouldn't go ahead with a big policy to replace the Russians with people from all around the world. I think they've even put that into their new constitution of what it means to be Russian. It's an ethnic designation. And they won't start replacing themselves in the same way that the West has. So we do still have hope in the East. If this, you know, if things keep going in the way they're going, the East will still keep civilization going, I think.
Yeah, we can hope. There's a lot of nationalists and other people that would argue that a lot of the East is no longer traditionally white, as they'd say, has been somewhat mixed. But I don't see that. I mean, a lot of Russians look very distinctly white, don't they?
Yeah, if you're talking about places like Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan and the actual Asian areas of the Soviet Union that are part of the Russian Federation, well, yeah, they're non-white. If you look at the Caucasian areas, Georgia, Azerbaijan, those sorts of areas around there, they're non-white as well, really, I would say. Some of them look white. Some of them don't look white, but they're not. Go on.
I was going to say on the fringes borders, you're going to get some overlap, aren't you? It's like southern Bulgaria, which is connected to Turkey. You know, you can see a distinct sort of gradation.
Yeah, in areas like that, you'll get that happening, but you won't get them as all the way in Siberia and Katerinburg, St. Petersburg, and places like that. I mean, Finland is, or Helsinki is full of Somalians. But if you go to Russia, which is bordered up with Finland, I doubt whether you see any Somalians there. You might, in Moscow, yeah. you might see, I guess, some of the Kazakhstanis or the Turkmenistanis. You might see them working there. They've had a big push to actually remove them back to the countries that they actually came from. The immigrants that have moved there for work, they're not given permanent right to stay there in Moscow. They're allowed to move there and do some work, and then they have to go back. So they're not looking at it as we need to import these people because we haven't got enough of a birth rate. They're just saying, well, we'll allow these people to come in and work because we need workers, but then they'll have to go back again.
Yeah.
So a different way of looking at it. Well, getting back to this then, this is why I was sort of building up to this with the Hyksos, because this is the period with Joseph, and the mainstream narrative is that the Pharaoh that looked after Joseph was one of these Hyksos types, but that's impossible when we actually look at the story. It was around this time that Joseph came into Egypt. The country's power was on the wane, and the rightful Pharaoh was a subordinate to the Canaanite types from the surrounding lands, and that's the Hyksos. The story of Joseph in Egypt has been deliberately misconstrued in modern times by anti-Christian nationalists to try and make it look like he was scheming against the neighbouring tribes and introducing taxes, when what he actually did led to the salvation and the liberation of the Egyptian Empire. If you read the passages carefully in the Bible, you will see that it does not tell you the story that is outlined in Moses from Bolshevism to Lenin at all. Quite the opposite, in fact, and that's a book that was supposedly written before Hitler came to power in Germany, that tries to claim that the Israelites were Bolsheviks, basically. And I doubt, well, there's nothing to officially say that was Hitler's views. And I think, personally, I think the book could have been put out to discredit him, but that's a subject for another day. But it's not just in that book. I mean, you must have heard of it, Patriarch as well, where people will try and say that Joseph took all the money and he got loads of wealth for his people, and what didn't do very well by the Egyptians was behaving in a bad way and all that sort of thing. And they try to bring that up and say, this is evidence that Joseph was just like today's modern Jews. And it's quite the opposite, the way that Joseph acted, to the way that they describe. Have you heard that at all?
Mm. No, I've not heard them accusations myself. And I'd always saw Joseph as, you know, being quite favourable to the Egyptians, really. He was a humble guy, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was really good.
He seemed to have his own interests at heart at all. I never got that impression. I don't know how that could be argued.
I think it's because of the taxes that he imposed, basically, and then people tie it on to Moses. But again, we'll get into Moses when we get there. But Joseph started life thinking he was better than his brothers. But the punishment they gave him for this far outweighed his lack of humility when they sold him into slavery. They would eventually be punished for this by their descendants being enslaved in Egypt for 400 years. But if they had not done this to him, then Joseph would not have been in a position to save the Egyptian Empire from starving to death. Now, we're probably all aware that he was bought by, or his brothers sold him to the Egyptians, and he was then bought as a slave by Potiphar. Well, after being bought by Potiphar, Potiphar's wife tried to seduce him, but Joseph refused to do such a dishonourable thing to his master. Feeling spiteful and scorned by him, she accused him of trying to rape her and had him thrown into prison. While he was in prison, his talent for reading dreams was found to be true, and after a time, the Pharaoh heard of his reputation and asked him to interpret a dream. Joseph interpreted the dream and told the Pharaoh that it was a warning, that in 7 years' time there was to be a huge drought and famine throughout all the known land. He advised the Pharaoh to save all the produce he could so that they would still have food during that time and the Egyptian people would not all die of starvation. And Joseph was then put in charge of ensuring that Egypt survived. He was a farmer and the Egyptians were not. They saw farming as an abomination. So over the next 7 years, he put his skill at preserving grain to good use, and he ensured that enough was preserved to keep the Egyptian people alive. The famine came just as Joseph predicted, and because of his agricultural knowledge, there was enough food for the Egyptian people as well as for the nations around them. And Joseph managed to use the saved grain to buy up all the surrounding land for the Egyptian state. Now, this shows that he was Aryan, because he was an agrarian. He knew farming. He knew how to preserve all this grain for 7 years, and he knew how to plant it in order to get that amount of grain. And the Egyptians were not livestock farmers, and yet Joseph was a livestock farmer. So he wasn't a merchant, and his people weren't merchants. They were farmers. Now, the people he bought... Hmm. Do you want to add anything to that?
No, but I mean, fair points, very valid points.
The people he bought the land from, although they are identified as Egyptians, they offered to sell their land and themselves as servants to Pharaoh. So in the Bible, it identifies them as Egyptians, but the fact they offered to sell their land and themselves as servants to Pharaoh proves that they were not truly Egyptian. For if they were, they would have already been the servants of their Pharaoh. If they had not already stolen the land from Egypt, they would not have been able to sell it back. Joseph bought all the land that would afterwards be known as Egypt and then gave it all back to the Egyptian people, along with enough seed to sow it with. He then instructed them that they should pay 20% of the increase from the land back to the state. And this is what Clifton Emmerheiser ties in with these Hyksos. So the Hyksos owned this land. They were calling themselves Egyptian. And this land was then won back for the Pharaoh by Joseph. Now, around the time of Joseph, Egypt was being beset by various Canaanite raiders known as the Hyksos, which should not be confused with the earlier Hyksos who built the Great Pyramid. Many of these barbarian tribes had taken over whole swathes of Egypt, probably through usury as well as conventional warfare, since usury is one of the main crimes that the Canaanites are accused of in the Bible, along with race mixing and sexual perversions. Europe lost its sovereignty to the money power. Egypt lost much of its lands to the Hyksos, and they had lost much of their empire. The secular records tell us that these tribes, which were made up of what we would call today the Semitic type, were regularly invading and taking over the Egyptian lands. Joseph cleverly sold the grain that these Hyksos Canaanite people needed to live on in exchange for the land which they had swindled out of the Egyptian people. He did not sell the grain to get land or riches for himself, as is implied by the Antichrists, but sold the grain and gained all the land back for the Egyptian people's Pharaoh. It is also clear that the Pharaoh was white like Joseph, as long after he died, a much later Pharaoh came along who knew not Joseph. That's a quote. It says in the Bible that the Pharaoh who knew not Joseph is the one that started persecuting the Israelites, which meant that the Pharaoh that came along much later had to have been foreign. Because it's saying he knew not Joseph.
I mean, the obvious kind of assumption there when reading it, though, would be he knew not Joseph, as in he wasn't close to him as the Pharaoh, like the previous Pharaoh kind of grew to know him through the interpretation of dreams and such. Is there any way that it could just mean that?
No, that's very simple.
I know it's simple. That's what I'm saying. That would be the very obvious explanation.
Because this is
not possible.
No, this is like 200 years later or whatever. So of course he's not going to know Joseph. Okay. Joseph would have been dead a long time ago.
I'm just trying to ascertain the context for anyone else listening that's not as well read.
He knew Joseph. The Pharaoh that he came to obviously knew him as his people, but the Pharaoh that was there much later on, he knew not Joseph. And that's the reason why they were so against them. It had to have been a Hyksos. The one later on had to have been a Hyksos type again because of the way that he was persecuting them. This Pharaoh then enslaved Joseph's people, who up until that time had been farming in the province of Goshen, which the earlier Pharaoh had granted them in gratitude for Joseph's help. And when have the Jews ever been known as being farmers? The original Pharaoh even asked Joseph if he could provide particularly good farmers to look after the Egyptians' livestock for them. So they'd actually been given the best farming land in Egypt, which was down, or the best farming land that was in the lower part of Egypt rather than the upper part, which is where the Hyksos were. And they were given the best farming land that was actually there. So a pharaoh much later on, I mean, he would have known all of this. He would have known all of this history if he'd actually been a part of the people that had that knew who Joseph was.
Yeah.
But if it had not been for Joseph, the Egyptians would have died out during that seven-year famine. The empire would have fallen and been no more. As it was, Joseph cleverly obtained all their land back for them, and then reminded them of the importance of contributing to the good of all, so there was always a public fund put aside for the people's welfare in times of need. Joseph was clearly not Jewish in the modern sense, and the Egyptian people and the nations surrounding that entire area owed their very lives to him. This is also confirmed by Pharaoh asking for Joseph's father Jacob to give him his blessing. If Joseph had been foreign, or it had been thought that he was worshipping a foreign god, this blessing would not have been asked for. It was Pharaoh and his people that were helped by Joseph, not the other way around, and they had to have been aware of his noble heritage, or his father would not have been asked for this blessing. So again, that's another point. You know, there's no other reason why you would ask for a blessing from this person who was his former slave, his father, unless he was part of the same type of people, heritage. Knew who these people were, had the same heritage.
Mm. They obviously had faith, some form of faith in Joseph and that.
Well, there gets to be even more connections, which we'll see in a bit. The Jews today like to claim that they were the Israelites who were held in bondage in Egypt. But in Jesus' time, the Jews said that they had never been in bondage to any man, which is true, since their heritage goes back to the Edomians, and the Edomians had never been in captivity to the Egyptians, the Babylonians, or the Assyrians, as the Israelites were. Is that famous quote there in the New Testament where the Jews say that they were never in bondage?
Yeah, the scripture is John 8:33, they answered him, "We are offspring of Abraham and have never been enslaved to anyone. How is it that you say you will become free?" So when they say they're the offspring of Abraham, they obviously come through the line of Esau, but then Esau mixed in with the Canaanites, and that's where the Edomites came from, essentially. So technically they still claim lineage and descent from Abraham. But it's obvious though that they admit it themselves that they're clearly not of Hebrew ancestry, traditional Hebrew ancestry is the path that the Israelites came through.
Not lawful ancestry. I mean, it's, as you say, technically they could claim ancestry, but not legitimate ancestry, because it was through the marriages to strange wives, basically, because Esau married Canaanite women. So he lost his heritage. So Abraham was a distant ancestor, but they were not legitimate descendants from Abraham. Well, Clifton Emmerhiser has identified the Pharaoh that had Joseph as his vizier as Amose, who defeated the Hyksos. And he found a quote that appears to refer to this time period when Joseph won the Egyptian lands back from the Hyksos and the surrounding tribes. And this is from Frank J. Cosentino's book, The Bohem Journey to Egypt, Land of Tutankhamun. And he makes the following statement. Ahmose I, now a great hero of Egypt, was in a position to eliminate the feudal system, and he did. He confiscated the lands and the properties of the lords he defeated, and he stripped them of their peerage. Those who supported him during the long Hyksos War also turned their estates over to the pharaoh in return for retention of their old titles and offices. All of Egypt was once again the personal property of the pharaoh. So it doesn't make mention there of what Joseph did, but essentially what Joseph did was to win all these lands back and get the old titles back for the Egyptians from the surrounding peoples who had taken them. And they were the ones that needed the corn and the crops, because they were the ones that were starving. Then we get to Joseph's wife. Now, some nationalists make allegations that the Hebrews were always a mixed race or a kline, despite all their laws against this. And one of the reasons why this gets said is because Joseph was given a wife by the Pharaoh. The English translation of the Bible says that this wife was the daughter of a priest of the city of On, which is also called Heliopolis. But before that, it was called Beth Shemesh, which is a Hebrew word that means the house of Shem. It means the city of the Shemites. It does not tell us that this was a priest of the sun god or of Osiris, which is a Talmudic legend that was written down by the Jews 600 years after Christ. The Christian Bible just tells us that it was the daughter of a priest living in On. The Pharaoh obviously went to some trouble to find this wife for him, searching Egypt until he found a suitable woman in the city that was also known as the House of Shem. She could not have been Egyptian, as that would have broken the customs of Joseph's people, and it would have offended him. The Pharaoh wanted to please Joseph. He would not have been trying to force him to marry an Egyptian woman who served a foreign god. when he'd refused to sleep with one already and been unjustly jailed for doing so. And he would have much less been trying to get him to marry a Canaanite Hyksos woman. And Joseph remained in Egypt with his tribe, and they spent 400 years there growing at a rapid rate, owing to their remarkable fecundity, and we will join them again at the time of Moses. And what Clifton does is he's gone quite into detail with this, and why this city was originally called Beth Shemesh. And he ties it in to this building of the Great Pyramid. And that he says that was built by a member of Shem's family. And there was somebody there that stayed with it. And there are these records that there was a priest there that stayed with the pyramid. And he says that this priestly line would have continued. And that's where they were, was at this Beth Shemesh, the house of Shem. And that's why the Pharaoh was able to find him a wife from this place here. So you were saying earlier about them having a similar religion, or somehow they knew something about this. Well, this was why, because they had this city there that obviously had a Hebrew priest there, and it would have been someone from the line of Melchizedek. And there's also a bit that ties in that after the people had actually built the pyramid, the Great Pyramid, the majority of them went off and founded the city of Jerusalem. And then you get the priest that was actually called Melchizedek, or the priest from the line of Melchizedek, and he was at Jerusalem, and then Abraham came after fighting a battle and then paid his tithes to him, this Melchizedek priest.
That's interesting, because I always wondered how Jerusalem was created in the first place, because it existed before the Israelites got there, didn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, well, this is what Clifton ties in. Yeah, okay. He claims it was founded by the same people that built the Great Pyramid. After that, they left, and that's what we learned last week in the records of it. It said this new people came in. There was no battle or anything like that, and they directed the Egyptians to build the Great Pyramid. They had the architect with them, and they got them to build the Great Pyramid. They then left their priest there, and obviously the priest would have had his own family and everything that he needed, and a retinue, and the rest of them then left Egypt. So they just moved into the country, built the Great Pyramid, and then left. And it says that they then left and they went and built Jerusalem. And obviously they must have left one priest there at Jerusalem. But Jerusalem itself then became a Canaanite city. But this priest was still there because when Abraham went there, he paid tithes to this priest. And he had bread and wine with this priest. And then when you get to the New Testament and you get Christ with the bread and the wine, it tells you that that's in reflection of this meeting with Abraham and this priest of Melchizedek. And it tells us that Christ is to do with this priesthood. So there was this original priesthood that existed before the Levites, basically, has precedence to the Levites. And it was to do with that, somebody to do with that, that built the pyramid and that also founded Jerusalem. So there's all these bits that tie in with what it says in the Bible that are just not really known about.
Is that a priesthood example actually in the Bible?
Yeah, yeah. The teacher of righteousness. As I say, Abraham goes to him and pays him tithes. And then if you read the book of Hebrews, it says that Christ is in this line of the priest of Melchizedek. Order of Melchizedek, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The Melchizedek, okay. Michael Zadok, I think is what some people say that it's referring to. So interesting stuff to do with Joseph. Anything else you'd like to add to that?
Not really. There's been a lot to take in today.
Yeah, well, it seems like an opportune moment to finish. We've actually finished it on time, and we've actually finished that section. I just hope I was clear enough about it. If I remember any bits that I wasn't clear about, then I'll bring them up next week, and the same for you. So thank you very much for coming on today.
You're welcome. Thanks again for having me.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday with more patriotic history for you, and of course we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.